There were a number of political contributions to the Library of Canadian Political Books this fall. One, Full Circle, Death and Resurrection in Canadian Conservative Politics, sets forth for the first time a definitive account of the events that led to the bust-up of the Progressive Conservative Party, the backstage machinations that led to the rebirth of the Conservative Party in Canada's new government, and the events in between. The book, 3695 from Key Porter, is written by conservative insider and one of Canada's leading public policy specialists, Bob Plamondon, who joins me this morning. Its foreword is written by Lawrence Martin. On its cover are Preston Manning, Stephen Harper, and Peter McKay. Their photographs are mounted on the telling photograph of Brian Mulroney and Joe Clark from 1983. We'll talk to the author about these five figures who have affected not only conservative politics and their parties, but also Canadian political history. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Bob Plamondon. Good morning, Mr. Plamondon.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. May I ask what your current involvement in the Conservative Party? What is that, if any?
Well, I'm a member of the Conservative Party of Canada, and I'm a supporter. I'm a small C conservative, but I don't work for the party. I don't work for any official. I'm a observer in many ways, and I might offer advice from time to time, but I don't have an official role in the party.
And you've run as a candidate before. You've worked in the back rooms, if you will.
I was a candidate in the 1988 election for the Progressive Conservative Party. I have volunteered and served in national campaigns. I've voted for the PC Party, for the Alliance Party, and obviously for the new Conservative Party. So I'm a partisan, and I'm active. But again, I'm not on anyone's payroll.
When you saw Stephen Harper in the 1990s as a member of Parliament, and when he became head of the National Citizens Coalition, even when he returned to politics to challenge and subsequently beat Stockwell Day for the leadership of the Alliance, was it the belief of observers that this was the person to bring conservatives together, let alone become Prime Minister one day?
Well, some may have thought that, but I think there was still a, at that point in time when he won the Alliance leadership, there was still a battle between the PC Party and the Alliance Party for survival and supremacy. And it was unclear to me, and I think to most observers, who was going to win that race and how it was going to turn out. I don't think anyone was predicting that either when Harper won the Alliance leadership in 02 or McKay won the leadership in 03, that there would be a united conservative movement for the 2004 election.
I want to talk about as I listed those five people that are on your cover. I want to talk about Peter. I'll talk about Peter McKay, but someone who makes an appearance in the book, and I hadn't read this before about him, David Orchard, was his friendship with Pierre Trudeau. You go into that.
Well, David Orchard is an interesting character, you know, very colorful, and he has a particular point of view that he wants to express. He's, you know, he's a nationalist, and he's concerned about free trade, and he, you know, tried to find himself a home in the Progressive Conservative Party in its relatively weakened state, and, you know, got a lot of play. And, you know, he was also an opponent of the Meech Lake Accord, which brought him into favor with Pierre Trudeau. And you know, he's a writer of sorts. I mean, he has a book, and he, you know, publishes articles in magazines. So he's somewhat provocative, and so that's got him in touch with Pierre Trudeau, who has been a mentor of sorts of his. You know, as well as John Turner, and he's spoken with Jean Chrétien. He seems to have spoken with more liberals necessarily than conservatives, which is odd for someone who's run for the leadership of the Progressive Conservative Party on two occasions. But, you know, he has found himself in some interesting places, and, you know, I don't think anyone knows about his relationship with the former Liberal Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau.
I hadn't read that before, that Trudeau had encouraged him to join the Progressive Conservative Party so as to give him a vehicle for his ideas and his ideals, I guess.
Well, his main issue was free trade, and Trudeau told him that there was no natural home for him, you know, that he could express those ideas in any party. I mean, by the time he got active in politics, the Liberal Party was supportive of free trade, and so was the Progressive Conservative Party. With Jean Chrétien in power, it was going to be very difficult for him to penetrate the Liberal Party. So, you know, he looked back on history and saw that his views were not unlike those of John George Diefenbaker. Or if you go back even further about Borden, who won an election on free trade over Liberal leader Laurier. So, you know, he thought he was bringing the party in some ways back to its roots.
I bring him up in just prefacing going into Peter MacKay, because MacKay's reputation sort of tattered when he went supposedly back on this deal with Orchard that helped him win MacKay the leadership of the Tory party. I guess it was 02, was it?
03.
Has MacKay's reputation within the party or within conservative circles sort of diminished because he went back on that deal?
No, I think it's enhanced, substantially enhanced. You know, Peter MacKay had a tough choice to make. Well, first, the choice that he made at the convention was to sign the deal with Orchard to win. If he had not signed that deal with Orchard, he would have lost. And the party, I think, would have been in some state of disarray, because Prentice would have been the leader and he would have had a difficult time bringing the party together. So he made that first difficult decision to sign the deal with Orchard, never expecting that he would have on the table the deal to merge on essentially every term and condition that was, you know, that he wanted. I mean, Stephen Harper, at the end of the day, said, you can have everything you want. The only thing I need is a single party and a leadership contest. Put everything else in the deal that you want. So what did MacKay have? He had a tough decision to make. Do I honor my deal with David Orchard, or do I unite the conservative movement, restore meaningful democracy to Canada, and, you know, at long last, have an election that counted, that where the conservatives could actually win? So, you know, he surrendered his leadership of a national political party before he had a chance ever to meet the electors, you know, for the sake of democracy. So, he is a hero for what he did. And he certainly, you know, paid a price, because his credibility outside of conservative circles on the street is affected by this, you know, the stench of this Orchard deal, the so-called, you know, Faustian agreement that he signed.
You seem to say that Harper sort of gave in terms of giving MacKay every condition that he wanted, so that the merger could have been sealed. Is that correct?
That's correct. I don't know that that's how he went into the negotiations, but MacKay left him no choice. He said, I want to get all of these, you know, particular conditions. And Harper compromised in ways that no one thought that he ever would. But he had a bigger goal in mind as well.
Yeah, I guess that reveals something about Stephen Harper, does it not?
Well, it revealed something to me. I did not expect that he would be a leader that could draw people together, that could compromise for the sake of a larger goal. You know, he was always known as somebody who had to get his way, and if he didn't get his way, he became sullen and withdrawn and resigned. So he was a new man. You know, he showed me a lot in those negotiations, and he gave in essentially on the one key issue about every riding in the country having an equal say in who becomes the leader of the party. And that's not something that he believed in. He believed in each member should have one vote, and all members should count equally.
You mentioned his that if he never got his way, he'd probably, you know, that he would be sullen and resigned and so on. I guess that points to the relationship with Preston Manning.
Well, there was a number of occasions when he disagreed with Preston Manning and went off on his own. I mean, Stephen Harper wanted to build a principled conservative party, an alternate conservative party to the PC party, and hopefully become dominant. Preston Manning wanted to build something else. It was a populist party, a member-driven party, not necessarily ideological in any way. Stephen Harper wanted to go write policy papers, and Preston Manning wanted to consult forever and ever. And even if the consultations, you know, brought him to a place where, brought him to a bad policy, he'd accept it. So, you know, that led to a number of disagreements. They disagreed over the strategy on the Charlottetown Accord. They disagreed over who should run the campaign, the National Reform Campaign, and ultimately, you know, well, first Harper retreated to his riding in 1993 and didn't get involved in the national campaign when he disagreed what was going on. And then in 1997, you know, he did the unthinkable. He resigned his seat as a member of parliament and, you know, at a very young age, when he had a high profile in the national press, to run the National Citizens Coalition, because he just was at, you know, at loggerheads with Preston Manning, and his approach at that point was to leave.
I'm talking with Bob Plamondon, the author of a great new book, Full Circle, Death and Resurrection in Canadian Conservative Politics, 3695, from Key Porter. Back to McKay for just a sec. What is his role in the current hierarchy, I guess, of the Conservative Party, and what is his relationship with Stephen Harper?
Well, he is the, you know, the senior cabinet minister, you know, Minister of External Affairs. He's on priority and planning. He's, you know, he's one heartbeat away, you could say, from the top job. So, you know, he is, you know, he's an important figure. He brings, you know, a balance to the party. You know, the party is not just one sect of the conservative movement. It draws together various factions of conservatism from across the country. He's very important in Atlantic Canada, and he's popular in, you know, particularly the East, Eastern Canada. And so I think he brings a lot to the party. So, you know, he's fundamental from that perspective.
And he gets along with Harper fine?
You know, he, there's a couple of interesting anecdotes that I bring up in the book. With the defection of Belinda Stronach, Stephen Harper was a great support to Peter McKay. You know, he's not known for being, you know, emotive and someone who would be there for you in the crunch. He's a, you know, a policy guy, a policy wonk. But during the course of that, he really built a bond and a friendship with McKay that has helped them. So they, you know, I think they get along very well. You'd find Peter McKay often taking Stephen Harper's son to hockey games, or you know, for the Ottawa Senators, or going to his minor league hockey games, or practicing with them. I think there is a friendship and a bond there that extends beyond politics.
You mentioned Belinda Stronach. Much was made of her role in the merger. Was her role that significant?
Well, you know, at various points in time, she added encouragement to the mix. You know, she thought it was a good idea that these two parties get together. I mean, you know, so did almost everybody in the conservative movement at some point, except for a few. It was just a hard objective to achieve. I'd give her the role of cheerleader. You know, she if it looked like the, you know, things weren't going very well, she'd, you know, call up particularly the Alliance side and encourage them to go to meetings. She, you know, she would be you know, someone who might take notes at the odd meeting. But in terms of vision, in terms of content, in terms of understanding politics, most of those who were at the table said she was more inclined to get in the way as opposed to be a help. She was no mastermind, but she did provide encouragement. And, you know, she was, is someone, because of her wealth, who can get her phone calls returned. And, you know, she was connected to, you know, many Tory luminaries like Brian Mulroney and Bill Davison and Mike Harris, who sat on, you know, either boards or were connected to her from a business perspective. So she could get her phone calls returned, and I think that was helpful.
The relationship between McKay and Stronach is not something that I guess people do want to talk about it and listen and about it, but I'll bring it up simply because it sort of affected the course of events politically. She decided to leave. They were in a relationship, I guess. There was a point in your book that you talk about where she nearly called it off.
Well, she did. She tried to call it off. What happened was, you know, the evening before, she had dinner with McKay, then she had another dinner with Prime Minister Paul Martin. You know, the deal was sealed, and then returned back to the suite at the Chateau Laurier, where she was living effectively with Peter McKay, and eventually he could sense something was up and, you know, dragged it out of her that she, in the morning, she was going to become a Liberal. And, you know, he spent that evening talking her out of it. You know, she was politically naive, really had no sense as to what this would do to her credibility, and you know, he saw this as a fundamental betrayal. And by 4 a.m, had her convinced that this is something she may not have thought through fully, and because she'd only been listening to the liberal spin doctors and leaders who were telling her what a great thing this was going to be and how she was going to be a hero. She hadn't heard the other side. So at 4 a.m, she calls her dad. You know, not many people would call their dad in the middle of the night, you know, to get some advice. And she called her her communications director and told them that the deal would have to be canceled or, you know, or at a minimum postponed. And so between 4 a.m. and 7 a.m, various other meetings took place. And she came back to the suite of the Chatelier after having promised McKay that she wasn't going to go through with it, to say it was too late. Of course, he told her that, you know, nothing was too late, and that it would never be too late until she walked into the parliamentary press theater to announce the you know, her defection. But you know, the train was moving, and she was overwhelmed by it.
And it was a shock at the time, but I guess Conservatives are probably glad that, as you said, that she was in the way a lot of the time that she did leave.
Well, as it turned out, I mean, I don't think they thought it was a good idea at the time, because she represented a, you know, a different part of a conservative ideology, and, you know, she softened the ticket somewhat, although she was you know, somewhat divisive in cabinet, and her leadership ambitions had never gone unchecked. But as it turned out, it was good, because it gave Stephen Harper and the party more time to prepare. It made the Prime Minister look like an opportunist for, you know, having, you know, brought her in with, you know, senior cabinet post, and, you know, it was, you know, it was not a, you know, a highly ethical move. And I suppose the best thing is that it turned out that Stronach was a lone wolf. If she had brought 5 or 10 members of the Conservative Party over with her to really divide the movement, then that would have been devastating. But, you know, as it turned out, no one went with her. The caucus rallied behind Stephen Harper. You know, their anger turned into energy and enthusiasm and, you know, more determination. So ultimately, I think she did Stephen Harper a favor.
I want to go back to the merger for just a second and talk about another figure on the cover there is Joe Clark. You reveal in the book that there was a secret proposal between Mr. Harper and Mr. McKay to make him interim leader of this new entity, and he rejected that?
Yeah, well, he rejected it by his actions and his words. I mean, they were looking for a bold gesture to, you know, to demonstrate that this was a big tent party, and you know, Joe Clark had been somewhat outspoken, but not, you know, completely vehement, but somewhat outspoken about the merger. And so inviting him to become interim leader would have been a, you know, dramatic step, and it would have reassured some of the progressive conservative party members who were feeling somewhat overwhelmed and were sensitive to the notion that this was a takeover. But you know, Joe Clark, through his you know, his vehement opposition and his, you know, vitriolic language, his hyperbole, you know, was enough to convince them that you know, he was not going to you know, to accept this position. He wasn't going to bless this merger in any way, shape, or form. So they went on and appointed John Lynch Staunton, who was a senator from the former PC side, to be the interim leader.
Brian Mulroney, his role in the narrative is that you write is quite huge. He and Harper, encouraged the merger, and he has become friends with Harper, I guess, advising Harper, is that correct?
Yeah, both are correct. And he did so rather discreetly for quite some time. I don't think, you know, either one of them revealed the extent of it until the evening when Brian Mulroney was given the award for Canada's greenest prime minister, and Harper spoke about the advice that he had received. But it does go back to 2002, when Harper won the leadership of the alliance, when their conversations began. I mean, I think it was critical for the merger that Preston Manning be taken out of the picture completely, and that that whatever support Mulroney was giving to Harper, you know, be discreet. I don't think that anyone on the PC side of the family, or including Peter McKay, knew the extent to which Brian Mulroney was helping to orchestrate the merger from all sides. And I think Mulroney has proven to be an invaluable resource to Prime Minister Harper, well, both in preparing for the 2006 campaign when Mulroney laid out a strategy for him that was the difference between living at Stornoway and living at 24 Sussex Drive, and it wasn't that complicated, but it was it was the strategy that Mulroney had followed, and Harper did the same thing, and I think he's continued to be a source of counsel for Prime Minister Harper.
And Preston Manning, I guess, doesn't play as big a part as Brian Mulroney does in the current Conservative government, I guess, in advising.
They're not even on the same page. I think that, Preston Manning, well, he's leading a think tank right now on reinvigorating democracy, and which is consistent with his populist views and ideals. And, he is obviously still an important national figure, but I don't think that he is a close and sought-after advisor by this current government.
What do you think that says, though, to people in my part of the country who wear Mr. Manning's and his ideals are probably a little more popular than Brian Mulroney's, in that how Harper will be able to keep, as you said, a party that draws a variety of sects together, keep that together, especially when he doesn't even have Quebec sewn up quite yet?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, Harper has to be mindful of all aspects of conservatism, and that runs the ideological gambit as well as, the geographic interest. So, I think he still has to keep in mind, what those populist measures are. Although, taking David Emerson into his cabinet after having been elected as a liberal, against presumably the wishes of his riding, is not something Preston Manning would have done. He's quite adamant about that. But I think, what I'd like to say to people particular in Western Canada is that the single biggest contribution that Preston Manning made to Canadian democracy was three successive Liberal majority governments. By splitting the Conservative movement, by not having work within the Progressive Conservative Party, which he ought to have done, and Mulroney said he would have welcomed him into the party, and he would have had a senior role, but by starting something else different, by splitting the Conservative vote, which wasn't as big a factor out west because, reform members could get elected out west. And, it didn't matter whether it was a PC, the votes weren't being taken away from the PC party in a way that elected Liberals and New Democrats. But that's precisely what happened in Eastern Canada. And as a result, you got, as Prime Minister, for three majority governments, from the same party that introduced the National Energy Program, from the same party that that laid the foundation for a huge debt and deficits. This was a party that was not supportive of Western ideals. Western Canada has wanted free trade for a century, and they finally got it. With Brian Mulroney, originally the Liberals were not the party of free trade. So, my message is that, conservatives of all stripes have to work together. And sometimes they're going to make mistakes. The CF-18 decision where Brian Mulroney awarded an aircraft maintenance contract to a Quebec company over a superior bid from a company from Manitoba, Bristol Aerospace, that was a tragic error. And Brian Mulroney grossly underestimated the strength of Western alienation and the rise of populism. But don't cut off your nose to spite your face. Work from within. Maintain your conservative ideals, but do so within the logical, natural instrument, which is the single conservative party, which we now have.
Bob, thanks so much for joining us today. This has been fascinating. The book is great, and I do recommend people listening to us to go out and buy the book, and continued good luck with it.
Thanks very much, Joe.
It is called Full Circle, Death and Resurrection in Canadian